28 and one half minutes after the hour. Robbie, we are dealing in precision here this morning. Not 31, not 29, but, well, now it's 42. Okay, time's a-wasting here. Let's get into this. Pastor Robbie Pruitt joins us from Virginia. He's an Anglican pastor. He's got his church in Fairfax.
Fairfax, Virginia, yeah. Thanks for having me on, Jim. Great to be with you and Sharon on the Broken Road.
Sharon joins us too. Robbie, congratulations. I mean, I got the newsletter from Preserving Bible Times. It comes out, at least once a month, right? Sometimes you do more.
Yeah, actually, that was the second one for August, and we'll be putting one out early September as well.
Okay. I want to make clear that those are free. They come to you in email. You can sign up at preservingbibletimes.org, and you'll learn about context and discover some really valuable resources at Preserving Bible Times if you sign up for that Between the Lines newsletter. Really simple to do. And no, we don't keep all your personal information and sell it and do that. We just don't do that stuff. Feel free to sign up for that. You'll look forward to that every month. Robbie, you sent us topics. I'm sitting here. I always try to divine. That's probably not a word that you use and not like divine power, but like divining what you mean by all this. You've given us topics in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com, and I'm wondering, how are you going to weave all these together? Matthew 12 and Acts 10 and Solomon and the Queen of Sheba and David, City of David, archaeological. This will be a challenge for you, Robbie. Have at it. I don't know where to start.
Right. Well, it started with my reading of this fall's edition of the Biblical Archaeological Review, which referenced one of my favorite passages in all of Scripture, kind of indirectly referenced it. This article appears on page 13. It's evidence of Solomon and Sheba.
Uh-huh.
And it comes from basically a little obscure verse in Kings that the Queen of Sheba visited King Solomon to scope out his wisdom. And that comes from 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 1. It says, "Now when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions." And that's important because Solomon is known for his wisdom. He actually prayed and asked God for wisdom, and God not only gave Solomon wisdom, but he gave him descendants. Solomon had 700 wives, 300 concubines. He was wealthy. Most people believe that he is the preacher, Koheleth, that writes the book of Ecclesiastes.
Mm-hmm.
And the Queen of Sheba, which is modern-day Yemen, comes up from the south to inquire of Solomon's wisdom. And she's not left lacking. She is so impressed and stays with Solomon and brings him gifts. And so you can see all of this in the annals of the kings.
Solomon was known for his political alliances, and the Queen of Sheba would have been significant. I remember reading about what Yemen was back in Bible times, and it was a very green, lush, important trading kingdom, and they had a system of dams that provided water. She was the queen of a significant economic entity. I'm not sure what it was they traded, but I can see strategic alliances there being important to both Solomon and to Sheba. But she represents something else too. Now, and that might bring us to Matthew. The kingdom of the south is referred to. Jesus is responding to the Pharisees. So let's get into that and find out if there's a connection here. I suspect there is.
Absolutely. So in Matthew chapter 12, starting at the towards the end of the chapter, you get the sign of Jonah starting in verse 38, and this passage will go through verse 42. So verses 38 through 42 of chapter 12 of Matthew says, "Then some of the scribes and the Pharisees answered Jesus, saying, 'Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you.'" Now these are Jewish Pharisees, teachers of the law, and mark this because they're seeking a sign. "But he answered them, 'An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, but no sign will be given to it except for the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days, three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will rise up in judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up, and there it is, the queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And then Jesus ends with this, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here. So Jesus is claiming to be the greater Jonah and the greater Solomon. Jesus is the embodiment of wisdom. And Solomon, the wisest person that ever lived up until this time, was visited by the Queen of the South. And you're right to point out the land of modern-day Yemen. It's near the Gulf of Aden, the Arabian Sea, and the intersections of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea. So this is modern-day Yemen. She had to come up from the south, this lush green land, to visit Israel.
We should add, that's a primary trade route that goes south to Africa and then across to what is now Yemen. Now it's desert. It's dry. It's hot. It's desolate. But in those days, they had an intricate system of irrigation set up with dams and rivers, and they had water. And it was a lush green kingdom that was prospering. So there's where the queen comes in. And again, I think it was probably a good political alliance. But I'm kind of surprised to hear Jesus refer to that. That must mean that it was top of mind for the Pharisees. I mean, they would have recognized that instantly.
And look what they're looking for. They're looking for a sign that he is who he says he is. And this comes in Matthew chapter 12, where Jesus is basically indicting them, because right before this, he says that a tree can be known by its fruit. And so Jesus is teaching. He heals the man with the withered hand earlier in that chapter. And so you see these miracles and these teachings, and they're still not convinced that Jesus is who he says he is, and they're looking for a sign. And Jesus juxtaposes the religious leaders, the Pharisees, looking for a miraculous sign, and he says, I'm going to give you one, and that's going to be the prophet Jonah. And Jesus here leverages the prophet Jonah as a foreshadowing of Jesus, saying just as Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days, three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth. So he's talking about his death, burial, and resurrection. He's talking about being buried, going into the depths of Hades to descend.
Question, is that where we get that notion? That he descended to somehow rescue those who were trapped or engulfed or assigned to Hades or to hell? Is that where that notion whole comes
from?
Well,
the imagery is there, and I'll tell you where it is. It's in, if you ever read Jonah chapter 2, and juxtapose and compare Jonah chapter 2 with Psalm 22. And when Jonah prays, as he goes to the roots of the mountains down to the abyss, so Jesus is invoking this with the double remez that's in Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus is invoking Psalm 22. And if you look at Psalm 22, that prayer of agony, which Jesus is invoking at his death, also describes in great detail his burial and his ascent to the dead. And then, of course, Peter picks up on this in 2 Peter, saying that he preached to those who were in the days of Noah. So that's where we get that imagery. But that's not necessarily where I want to camp out, though. That's here. That's in this text of Matthew 12. What's interesting to me was my reading this month in the Biblical Archaeological Review, BAR, in their fall 2023 edition, has an article on page 13 about evidence of Solomon and Sheba. So apparently there's been pottery found in the Ophel, the city of David, and we know that Solomon is the son of David, and he inherits his father's kingdom. And Solomon builds the temple. We know that David can't do that because he has blood on his hands. But we also know that Solomon takes the throne of his father. So where is the throne of David? Where is the city of David but the south of the city? In the Ophel, the old Jebusite city. And so in the archaeological finds in 2012, they have discovered, just 11 years ago, pottery which has inscriptions on it, most likely from Sheba, from the Queen of Sheba. So when she comes and brings offerings and gifts to Solomon, she comes bringing, bringing all of her wealth. And so there's this large storage jar that held probably around 30 gallons or 5 ephahs, the standard volume of measurement in ancient Judah. And it has this inscription, which some scholars have said this could be Canaanite, but others are saying that, no, this is coming from the south. This is imported pottery holding the offerings from with the Sabian language on it, which is biblical Sheba.
Hmm. By the way, anybody interested in reading the article can click on that link that Robbie gave us in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com, and it's got a picture of this and an article to go along with it. It's fascinating stuff. I've never doubted the visit, though. It made so much sense politically and economically for that to happen. But it took a while to learn what Sheba was as a kingdom, why it was of significance, and it was. But we look at the earth today and we see different things, vastly different setting in Yemen than was true back then. And not that it was huge, but it was rich and again, lush and green and powerful economically. So this is a logical occurrence.
And the history actually with the Israelites can even date back to one of the oldest books of the Bible, which oldest historically, which is Job. And Job actually had the Sabians come and steal some of his livestock. And so you can read about this when the sons and daughters are drinking. This is Job 1, verses 13 through 15, that the Sabians fell and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And so you see this conflict even in the days of Job with these Sabians.
I never would have connected that with Sheba, but Saba, right. S-A-B-A, is the name for Sheba that they used.
Exactly. And you also find these folks in Joel. So in Joel chapter 3, this is the minor prophet Joel, it says, I will sell your sons and your daughters into the land, into the hand of the people of Judah, and they will sell them to the Sabians, a nation far away, for the Lord has spoken. Now, Joel occurs after the time of the Queen of Sheba's visit to Solomon in around 900 BC. And so Joel is going to come, you know, hundreds of years later, the minor prophet Joel, right before the intertestamental period at 400 BC. So we have this long history with the Sabians, with this land of Yemen, the Sheba and the Queen of Sheba. And it's even in Isaiah, we see that the wealth of Egypt and the merchandise of Cush and the Sabians, men of stature shall come over to you and be yours. They shall follow you. They shall come over in chains and bow down to you. They will plead with you, saying, surely God is in you, and there is no other, no God beside him. So this is Isaiah 45, 14. So you see in the prophets, the minor prophets, and in the history books of Israel with Job, you see Sheba, you see the Sabians, you see this relationship with these foreigners, with the Israelite people, for better and for worse. And you see blessing and you see judgment. And you see the wisest and the powerful rulers coming to see this wise King Solomon. And then Jesus says in Matthew 12, something greater than Solomon is here. Jesus is wisdom personified. The sign of Jonah is power. It's resurrection coming about. as Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days, three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth 3 days, three nights. And Jesus raises from the dead. Why? Why is Jesus vomited upon the shores of resurrection? So that he can go preach to his enemies. What did Jonah do? Jonah went and preached to the Ninevites after he was vomited upon the shores. When he tried to flee from God's call, he flees from Joppa. And if you know anything about Acts chapter 10, Peter's vision of a sheet coming down happens near Joppa.
Uh-huh.
And when Peter is there and God shows him a sheet with every animal, and he says, "Arise, Peter, kill and eat." And he said, "No, Lord." And God tells Peter, "What I pronounce to you as clean, you cannot say is unclean." And then God calls Peter to go and baptize Cornelius and all of his household in Acts chapter 10.
And three times that happened. That number again. Three pops up, which adds to the significance. Yeah,
exactly. And Paul picks this up, and it comes full circle after the resurrection and the ascension of Jesus. Paul writes the church in Corinth, and he addresses these two issues of power and wisdom. And he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 22 through 24, Paul says, "For the Jews demand signs, and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews, and foolishness or folly to the Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God." Where does Paul get this? I would venture to say Paul gets this from Jesus's own teaching amongst his disciples and these religious rulers in Matthew 12, where Jesus himself said something greater than Solomon is here. A greater wisdom, an embodied wisdom is here. Something more powerful than Jonah is here. A greater sign is here than the sign of Jonah. I'm going to defeat death and resurrect from the grave after 3 days. That's the image that Jesus is invoking. He's invoking his power, and he's invoking his wisdom. He's invoking Jonah, and he's invoking Solomon.
Robbie, you are so good at picking up the pieces and knitting them back together so we can see the picture. One thought occurred to me during your description of all the involvement of the prophets and the ties with Sheba and the Queen of Sheba is we often look at the Old Testament in particular, and we read it in a few chapters or a few verses, and it goes by quickly. We forget how long that history took to develop, and how many things happened over the eons from the time of the Exodus to the time of the intertestamental period. So much happened that we don't know about or take for granted. One of the questions I'd like to ask is, what was the Pharisaic view of Solomon then? Because we're taught that Solomon went wrong, he went bad. The 700 wives and all his investments in his military, he was falling into a trap that God said would happen to kings. They would become tied by their wealth and their political connections, and maybe he turned out to be not so bright after all, in our view. But it appears that if Jesus used this example, the Pharisees had a different vision of him, a different opinion.
Yeah, so Solomon is the last king of the United Monarchy. You really only have three kings in the United Monarchy. You have Saul, you have David, and you have Solomon. And Solomon, don't forget, fulfilled his father's vision to build the temple on the Temple Mount, the old threshing floor in the Jebusite city. And so Solomon is building the place for God to dwell amongst his people, the physical place. Now, we do know him is wrong because hindsight is 20/20, and these Pharisees speaking with Jesus also have the same hindsight. You're correct. I mean, we're talking 4,000 years of Israelite history from Job to present day, our day. And then 11 years ago, we're finding archaeological evidence for the Queen of Sheba's visit to Solomon, right there on the south of the Temple Mount in the Ophel, the old city of David. And so Solomon, for better or for worse, built the temple of God. And when, you get this image when they're even, when Jesus is provoking the religious leaders and he says, you know, you destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days. And they say, are you greater than Solomon? And
so that would have been the high point then. That was Solomon's achievement that stuck in their minds, the building of the temple. Okay.
Yeah, and we throw the baby out with the bathwater when somebody fails, like Solomon certainly did. I mean, after his death, you know, because he had intermarried and was being led astray by these political, as you mentioned earlier, Jim, you talked about the political alliances, that you're not surprised by the Queen of Sheba's visit, that Solomon was marrying outside of Israel in order to bring peace with outside nations.
Which was forbidden.
Right. And not only that, I mean, he was participating in idolatry because of it. And because of it, you know, the kingdom is torn from north to south, which, by the way, is the image at the beginning of Solomon's reign when he pulls out the sword and he's going to cut the baby in half. That is a foreshadowing of the kingdom being torn in two, rended from north to south.
Yeah, and for those who are short on geography, Israel was the kingdom of the north. Right. Judah was the kingdom of the south. So there was a split, separate kings, separate histories until the first century.
Right. And so this image of when Solomon is being praised for his wisdom, they say, we've never seen wisdom like this. There's these two women, and one rolls over on her baby and kills her baby. And so these two women are taking the remaining baby, because both of them had infants, and they were fighting over the living infant. And Solomon says, bring me a sword, and he's going to cut the baby in half. And in doing so, he's not actually going to do it, but he's going to threaten to do it. And in doing so, he identifies the true mother, who is willing to allow the other woman to have the baby just to spare the baby. And in that, Solomon identifies only a mother's love and care would want to keep the baby whole. And he gives the baby back to the mother. And everyone's astounded at his wisdom. And this is a foreshadowing literary device that is going to bookend. So you've got a whole baby at the beginning of Solomon's reign, and then at his death, you've got the kingdom baby torn in two from north to south. So Solomon, in with all of his flaws, certainly built God's house, and that's nothing to shy away from.
There's something else, another connection with Solomon I want to mention here, too, and that's on what we call Palm Sunday. When Jesus arrived in Jerusalem, he rode a donkey down the hill from the Mount of Olives. Is that not a remez to how Solomon was coronated and took the throne? He did the same thing, and I'm wondering if the Pharisees saw that, and it made them a little nervous.
It did, and so Solomon is being invoked. And he's being invoked quite often. And that is another remez, this
hearkening back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And so Solomon, the image of Solomon building the temple, and even the priest can't go into the temple. The image when the glory cloud, the Shekinah glory, fills the place, and no one can even come inside, that God's glory is so palpable. And this is a glorious, glorious thing that Solomon has done. And Jesus is, you know, using these things and provoking. He's saying destroyed in John chapter 2, verses 19. Jesus says, destroy this temple, I will raise it up. And then the Jews said, it's taken 46 years to build this temple. This was the second temple period, the rebuilding of Solomon's temple. By Herod the Great. But he was speaking about his body. Again, that link between the temple and Jonah and resurrection and destruction and coming back alive is all here in Jesus's narrative.
Boy, it all fits together so beautifully.
And I was thinking the look on a Jewish person's face when they make those connections is astounding, because we attended a Messianic Jewish congregation in Tucson for a while we lived there. And suddenly to make those connections between the imagery of the Old Testament and Christ's fulfillment of the New, you think, why didn't we see this sooner? Yeah. And even at that, with the Pharisees, it's like, how could they not see?
They were blind. So that's the case of the Old Testament being in the New Testament revealed, the New Testament in the Old Testament concealed. If we want to understand our New Testament, the best way to do it is to read the Bible Jesus read.
And I would submit that the Pharisees saw the real picture, but they had other things in mind. Wealth and power had stolen them away. Okay. Robbie is, I mentioned, he's an Anglican pastor. He's involved in a bicycle ministry. He preaches at homeless shelters. He's the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, too. And I wanted to recommend that website to you. There you will find quite a library of resources, ebooks and streaming video, things you can buy, things you can get for free that will lead you in your Bible studies or your personal study of the Scripture. That just open things up and you'll be able to read between the lines. We recommend a visit to them. You can link to them from our website at Broken Road Radio. It's preservingbibletimes.org. Robbie, thanks again and again and again for what you bring to us. We'll look forward to next week.
Joy and a privilege to be with you and Sharon. Godspeed. We'll see you next time on The Broken Road. Thanks again for having me on.
Take care. Thanks for being here.